objects would have made the cut. "Off you go," Pearl said. "Fog will probably have you take over the first-year class on minor mendings."
"I expect he will," Quentin said. And he did.
Chapter 3 Quentin thought he'd find teaching satisfying, but he didn't actually expect to enjoy it. That seemed like too much to hope for, but as it turned out, he did enjoy it. 5 mornings a week at 9 a.m., he stood up in front of minor mendings, chalk in hand, scribbled lecture notes in front of him, and looked out at the students, his students now, and they looked back at him. Mostly their faces were blank, blank with terror, blank with total confusion, blank with boredom, but blank. Quentin realized now that that must be how he used to look. When you were just one of the class, you tended to forget the professor could see you. His first lecture was not a success. He stuttered. He repeated himself. He lost his train of thought and stopped cold, dead air, while he tried to figure out where he'd been going with this a second ago. He'd prepared 10 points he wanted to cover, but he was so afraid that he'd run out of material that he dragged out the first point for half an hour and then had to rush through the other 9 at top speed to fit them all in. It turned out that teaching was a skill you had to learn, like everything else. But gradually it dawned on him that he at least knew what he was talking about. His track record in life and love wasn't exactly flawless, but he did possess a large amount of practical information about the care and feeding of supernatural forces, and teaching was just a matter of getting that information out of his head and into the clever, receptive heads of his students in orderly installments. It was a long way from running a secret, magical kingdom, but then again, Fillory had never really needed him that badly, had it? Fillory pretty much ran itself. Whereas these kids, floundering as they were in the choppy, frigid waters of introductory grammary, would have been lost without him. They needed him, and it felt good to be needed. Knowing his discipline helped, too. He'd always considered himself decent at magic, but he'd never had a strong sense of exactly who he was as a magician. Now he did. He was someone who fixed things. He saw that now. Give Quentin a broken object, and in his hands it woke up, as if from an unhappy dream, and remembered that it had once been whole. A smashed coffee cup, so utterly hopeless and without power, bestirred itself and regained some of its old gumption. It hadn't always been this way. No, it had once had a convenient handle. It had once had the power to hang on to a liquid instead of letting it gush through its shattered innards onto the floor. And with a little encouragement from Quentin, it would again. God, but he loved doing magic. He'd almost forgotten how satisfying it was, even the little things. Doing magic was like finally finding the words you'd been groping for your whole life. You'd always known what you wanted to say. It was on the tip of your tongue. You almost had it. You knew it a moment ago, but somehow forgot it. And then there it was. Casting the spell was like finally finding the words. There, that's what I meant. That's what I've been trying to say all along. All he had to do was explain this to his students. As a faculty member, he was also expected to conduct independent research, but until he could come up with a problem that was worth researching, teaching was what he did. He did it 5 days a week, a lecture at 9, and then practical applications at 2. At the same time, he settled back into the rhythm of life at Brakebills, which wasn't so different as a professor than it had been as a student. He didn't have homework anymore, but he had to spend his nights preparing lectures, which was fine because he didn't have much else to do anyway. He held himself appropriately aloof from his students, and so far the other faculty, appropriately or not, left the new fish to his own devices. Little things had changed. Rumor had it that Brakebills had acquired a ghost, and though Fogg hadn't seen it himself, it wasn't clear who had, he was bursting with pride about it. Apparently all the old European institutions had them, and in those circles a magic school hadn't really arrived till it was haunted. The library was still giving trouble. A few books in some of the more obscure corners of the stacks retained some autonomy, dating back to an infamous early experiment with flying books, and lately they'd begun to breed. Shocked undergraduates had stumbled on books in the very act. Which sounded interesting, but so far the resulting offspring had been either predictably derivative, in fiction, or stunningly boring, non-fiction. Hybrid pairings between fiction and non-fiction were the most vital. The librarian thought the problem was just that the right books weren't breeding with each other and proposed a forced mating program. The library committee had an epic secret meeting about the ethics of literary eugenics, which ended in a furious deadlock. Quentin could feel himself slipping back into the thick, rich, comforting atmosphere of breakbills, like a bee drowning in honey. Sometimes he caught himself thinking about what it would be like to stay there forever. And he might have done that if something hadn't interrupted him. His father died. It caught Quentin off guard. It had been a long time since he'd felt close to his father. He didn't think about him much, or his mother. It had never even occurred to him that his father could die. Quentin's dad had lived an unspectacular life, and he slipped out of the world at 67 with the unshowiness that was his trademark. He died in his sleep of a stroke. He even managed to spare Quentin's mom the shock of waking up next to a slowly cooling corpse. She was doing an artist's residency in Provincetown, and his body was discovered by the woman who did the cleaning instead, a stolid, rigorously Catholic Ukrainian who was in every way more spiritually prepared for the experience than Quentin's mom would have been. It happened in mid-October, about 6 weeks after Quentin came back to Breakbills. Dean Fogg brought him the news, which had been transmitted to him via the school's one ancient rotary telephone. When Quentin understood what Fogg was telling him, he went very cold and very still. It was impossible. It made no sense. It was as if his father had announced that he was going to take up mariachi drumming and march in the Cinco de Mayo parade. His father couldn't be dead. He wouldn't be. It just wasn't like him. Fogg seemed nonplussed by his reaction, almost disappointed, as if he were hoping to get a little more drama out of it. Quentin would have given him the drama if he knew how, but it wouldn't come. He didn't sob or tear his hair or curse the Norns who had snipped his father's thread too soon. He wanted to, but he couldn't, and he didn't understand why he couldn't. The feelings were missing. It was like they'd been lost in transit from whatever country feelings come from. Only after Fogg had offered him a week of compassionate leave, and then tactfully withdrawn, did Quentin begin to thaw out and feel something besides shock and confusion. And when he did, what he felt wasn't grief, it was anger. That made even less sense. He didn't even know who he was angry at or why. What, was he angry at his dad for being dead? At Fogg for telling him? At himself for not grieving like he should? When he thought about it, Quentin couldn't remember ever having felt very close to his father, even as a little kid. He'd seen photographs from his childhood that showed boy Quentin in scenes of ordinary family happiness with his parents, that could have been convincingly presented in family court as evidence that the Coldwater home was a warm and loving one. But Quentin didn't recognize the child who looked back at him out of those snapshots. He couldn't remember ever having been that person. He felt like a changeling. Quentin took Fogg up on that week of compassionate leave, not so much because he felt like he needed it, but because he thought that his mom might need the help. As he packed for the trip to Chesterton, Quentin realized he was gritting his teeth against actual panic. He was worried he wouldn't be able to feel the emotions people wanted him to feel. He made himself a promise that whatever happened, whatever anybody asked of him, he wouldn't pretend to feel anything he didn't really feel. If he could stick to that, things couldn't get too bad. And as soon as he saw her, Quentin remembered that even if he and his mom weren't especially close, they got along fine. He found her standing by the kitchen island, one hand on the granite countertop, a ballpoint pen next to it. She looked like her mind had wandered off in the middle of making a list. She'd been crying, but her eyes were dry now. He put his bag down, and they embraced. She'd put on weight. She made a significant armful now. Quentin had the sense that she hadn't talked to very many people since it happened. He sat down next to her on a stool.
"The tennis girls will be here in a minute," she said.
"That's good. Good to see them." The tennis girls, Kitsy, Molly, Rosalind, were his mother's best friends. It had been a long time since any of them had played tennis, if they ever had, but Quentin knew his mom could count on them.
"I wasn't done with the wall treatment in the bathroom," she sighed.
A heavy chunk of ice, like a giant tooth, hung from the eave outside the kitchen window. It was January in the real world.
"I knew he was going to hate it. I keep thinking that if he hadn't died, the wall would have killed him."
"Mom, the wall would not have killed him."
"I was doing mini palm trees. I hid it behind that old Japanese screen. I didn't want him to see it till it was too late to do anything about it."
She took off her oversized glasses and rubbed her face with both hands, like a diver taking off her mask after a deep descent.
"And now it's all too late. I don't know any of his passwords. Can you believe it? I can't even find his keys. I can't even get into the basement."
He made a mental note to locate those keys later with a spell. He might even be able to come up with the passwords, too, though that would be trickier. Part of the trouble between Quentin and his parents, he knew, was that they had no idea who he really was, which wasn't their fault because he'd never told them. Quentin's mom thought her son was a comfortably but not spectacularly successful investment banker specializing in real estate transactions. She didn't know that magic was real. Quentin's father hadn't known either. Quentin could have told them. The information was tightly controlled by magicians, and transgressions were punished sharply, but exceptions could be obtained for parents and spouses, and children over 14. But he never had, because it seemed like such a terrible idea. He couldn't imagine the two worlds touching. His parents' sedate, orderly, marital idol, and the wild, messy, arcane world of magic. It was impossible. They would explode on contact like matter and antimatter. Or he always assumed they would. Now he wondered if that secret, the absence of that confidence, was what had come between them. Maybe he'd underestimated them. Quentin and his mother spent his week of leave rattling around the Chesterton McMansion, like two dice in a plastic cup. It was a huge house for a middling successful painter and a textbook editor, bought with money from a Brooklyn brownstone they'd cashed out of at just the right time. There was a lot to do. Death was an existential catastrophe, a rip in the soft upholstery with which humanity padded over a hard, uncaring universe. But it turned out there were an amazing number of people whose job it was to deal with it for you, and all they asked in return were huge quantities of time and money. Quentin spent a whole day on the phone with his mother's credit cards fanned out on the cold kitchen counter in front of him. She watched him with wary surprise. They'd seen so little of each other these past few years that she still thought of him as the shoe-gazing teenager he'd been when he left for break bills. She was baffled by this tall, firm, no longer teenaged man who presented her with lists of urns to choose from, menus of hors d'oeuvres for the reception, times when town cars would pick her up and drop her off. At night they ordered takeout and played Scrabble and watched movies on the couch, drinking the Melanie Sonoma Chardonnay that she ordered by the case. At the back of his mind, Quentin kept queuing up and replaying scenes from his childhood. his father teaching him to sail on a sandy-bottomed brown water lake in New Hampshire, his father picking him up from school after he got sick in gym class. When he was 12, they'd had a full-scale blowout shouting match when his father refused to sign the permission slip for Quentin to go to a chess tournament. It was the first time he'd qualified in the under-15s, and he was desperate to make the trip to Tarrytown. It was strange. His father had never seemed comfortable with Quentin's efforts to stand out academically. You'd think he would have been proud. That first night, after his mom went to bed, Quentin went and sat in his father's study. It was a boxy, white-walled room that still smelled like new construction. The parquet looked brand new, except for the matte circle where the wheels of his father's desk chair had worn away the finish. He was half-drunk on Chardonnay. He knew what he was looking for. He was looking for a way to stop feeling angry. He was still carrying the anger around, and he wanted somewhere he could safely put it down. He sat in his father's chair and rotated slowly in place, like a lighthouse. He looked at the books, the files, the window, the dead computer screen. Books, files, window, screen. Particles of faint sodium orange light from the streetlights outside lay on everything like dust. That was when it occurred to Quentin for the first time that maybe his father hadn't been his real father. Maybe he wasn't who he appeared to be. Maybe Quentin's father had been a magician. The next morning, after his mother left to do a big shop at Whole Foods, Quentin went back to his father's study. He resumed his post in his father's chair. Quentin knew he was a little old to be wrestling with questions like this. Probably he should have had them wrapped up by around puberty. But he'd always paid more attention to magical problems than to the personal kind. Maybe that had been a mistake. Your father was supposed to love you, to pass on his power to you, to show you what it was to be a man. And his father hadn't. He'd been a good person, or good enough, but mostly what he'd showed Quentin was how to move through the universe while disturbing it as little as possible, and how to compile and maintain the world's most complete collection of Jeff Goldblum movies on Blu-ray, apart, presumably, from Jeff Goldblum's. Quentin hadn't had much luck with father figures. Not Dean Fogg, not Mayakovsky, not Ember, the ram god. They hadn't dispensed a whole lot of paternal wisdom to him over the years. Whatever power and wisdom they hadn't been eager to share it with him. Maybe they didn't want to be his father figures. Maybe he hadn't made an especially appealing son figure. Quentin tried to imagine what his father should have been like, the father he wished his father had been. Brilliant. Funny, intense, a bit of a rogue, at times even eccentric, but steady in a crisis, a man of grit and energy, a man who faced the world around him and brought it to heel on his own terms, a magician's father, a father who would have seen what Quentin had made of himself and been proud. But Quentin's father seemed not to have had any power at all, let alone any to share. Quentin's actual father had had one wife, one son, no hobbies, and probably a case of mild clinical depression, which he self-medicated with work. Not everybody led a double life, but Quentin's father had barely led a single one. How could somebody who seemed so determined to be powerless have a magician for a son? Unless he hadn't been powerless, Quentin thought, unless that wasn't the whole story. It was starting to sound like a cover story, exactly the kind of cover story a magician would use. Methodically, Quentin examined the study for evidence that his father wasn't what he seemed to be, that he'd left some legacy for his son, that for whatever reason he couldn't share with him while he was alive. He went through his father's filing cabinets. There were charms for searching paper documents for keywords, the same way computers searched digital files. He checked for codes or hidden scripts. He got back no results of any significance. He hadn't expected any. That was merely due diligence. Now the hunt could begin in earnest. He examined the light fixtures. He squeezed the couch cushions and pulled up the rugs. He used a spell to peer into the walls and under the floorboards. He looked behind the pictures. He scoured the room to the studs for any trace of hidden magic. But all he found was an old library book with a weak anti-theft charm put on it by somebody else, which in any case didn't appear to have worked. At least the missing keys turned up in the couch. He checked the furniture for hollow legs. He riffled through every book on the shelves in case one was underlined or hollowed out. Once in a while he thought he was picking up on something, a secret pattern or a code, but every time he did, it dissolved again like fairy gold back into random noise. What dark magics could his father have been trafficking in that he would have kept them this well hidden? That he would have leaned on his son, tried to stop him from drawing attention to himself? What sinister fate had Quentin avoided in Tarrytown? What did it mean that his father kept an old unstrung banjo in one corner? What was with his weird obsession with Jeff Goldblum? The longer he worked with no result, the more clearly he felt the ghostly presence of his father, his real father, his true father, as if he were in the room with him even now. Quentin booted up the computer, and after a half hour of sweaty-palmed cryptomancy and educated guesswork, he cracked the password, The Lost World, starring Jeff Goldblum, and began casing file directories one after the other. They were almost eerily clean. No diary, no poetry, no mistresses, no Ponzi schemes, nothing that wasn't what it appeared to be. Not even any porn. Well, not much porn. Quentin was no hacker. He'd spent way too much time in the technological black hole of breakbills to have any serious chops with computers. But he knew some electromagnetic sorcery. He cracked the case and went directly after the silicon, feeling with magical fingertips for anything weird, any walled-off caches of hidden electrons pregnant with meaning. All he could think was, this can't be it. This cannot be everything. He must have left me something. Come on, help me, Daddy. It was a word he hadn't said or even thought in 20 years. He stopped and sat for a minute, his hands trembling in the empty house, in the deep, cold, suburban winter silence. Where is it, Dad? It must be here. I can't be alone. You must have left me something. This was always how it worked. The distant, withholding father was always guarding a terrible secret, always keeping his son safe from it, able to pass on his legacy of power only in death. And then he found it. It was at the back of a closet, a nubbly red plastic carton of index cards, scribbled on in pencil, shoved behind a box of obsolete electronics and mysterious cables that were too important-looking to throw away. He set the carton on the desk and flipped through the cards one by one. Strange names, columns of numbers, pluses and minuses. It went on and on. It was a lot of data. A cipher like this could contain whole worlds of power if he could break it. And he would. It was left here for him. He stared at the cards for it must have been 10 minutes before the pattern solved itself all at once. It wasn't a cipher at all. These were stats from his father's old fantasy golf league. Quentin pushed the plastic box away from him violently, convulsively. The cards spilled out all over the rug. He left them there. There was no mystery to solve. What had come between him and his father wasn't magic. The terrible truth about Quentin's father was that he was exactly the person he seemed to be. He wasn't a magician. He wasn't even a good person. He was an ordinary man who hadn't even loved his only son. The hard truth was that Quentin had never really had a father. And now he never would. Quentin put his head down on his father's old desk and pounded his fist until his father's crappled plastic keyboard jumped.
"Daddy!"
he sobbed in a voice he barely recognized.
"Daddy! Daddy! Daddy!"
Quentin went back to Brakebill's the day after the funeral. He didn't like to leave his mother, but she was more comfortable with her friends than she was with him, and it was time for them to take over. He'd done his part. She drove him to the airport. He waited till she was out of sight before he walked away from the departure area to a parking garage that was still under construction. He took the elevator to the empty top floor. At the stroke of noon, under a flat white sky, a portal opened for him. A ring of white dots connected by white lines that sizzled and sparked in the cold, dry air, and he stepped through it and back onto the Brakebill's campus. Back home. Climbing the stairs to his room, he felt strange. It was like he'd had a week of high fever that had finally crested and broken, leaving him empty and cold and shaky, but also washed clean, the toxins sweated out, the impurities burned away. His father's death had changed him, and it was the kind of change that you didn't change back from. Daddy was gone. He was never coming home. It was time for Quentin to move on. When he walked into his room, Quentin performed a small incendiary charm to light a candle, a spell he'd done 1,000 times, but this time the sudden flare startled him. It was brighter and hotter than he remembered. Quentin snuffed out the candle and lit it again. There was no question. His magic was different. The light that played around his hands as he worked was more intense than it had been a week ago. In the darkness, the colors were shifted a bit toward the violent violet end of the spectrum. The power came more easily, and it buzzed harder and louder in his fingers. He studied his hands. Something had broken loose in him. He was truly alone in the world now. No one was coming to help him. He would have to help himself. Somewhere deep in his unconscious, he'd been waiting, holding back some last fraction of power. But not any more. Late that night, something woke Quentin up out of a deep, dreamless sleep. A dry, scrabbling noise. It sounded like a small rodent was trapped in his room. He lit a lamp. It was coming from his desk. It wasn't a rodent. It was a piece of paper. He'd all but forgotten about it. It was the page he'd snatched out of the air as he left the Netherlands and stuffed into his pocket and then shoved to the back of a desk drawer. Something had woken it up, and it was uncrumpling itself. When he opened the drawer, it made a wild bid for freedom. The page had folded itself in 3 sections like a business letter, and now it unfolded all at once, launching itself a couple of feet in the air. Having gotten that far, it hastily refolded itself the long way and began flapping frantically in circles in the dim light, around and around his head, like a moth around a lamp. Or like a memory of another life. Another world that wouldn't stay buried. Chapter 4 Quentin didn't look at the page from the Netherlands that night. That night he put a paperweight on it, locked the desk drawer, and propped a chair against it to make sure it stayed closed. He had to teach in the morning. He went back to bed and put a pillow over his head. It wasn't until late the next afternoon, after PA, that he unpropped the chair and unlocked the drawer. Slowly, he eased it open. The page had gone still, but evidently it had been psyching itself up for this moment, because as soon as he took away the paperweight, it took off again. Quentin watched it thrash along in the air, feeling a little sorry for it. He wondered where it was trying to get to. Back to the Netherlands, probably. Back home. He plucked it gently out of the air and took it over to the window seat so he could look at it in the sunlight. Holding it flat with his palm, he weighed it down at its four corners with a candlestick, an alarm clock, an empty wine glass, and a fossilized ammonite that he kept on his desk. The page knew when it was beaten. It gave up and went still. Now he could see what he was dealing with. The text was handwritten, both sides, closely and minutely lettered in black ink, with an occasional important word in red. It was a serious sort of page, dense with information. The paper was old, not modern paper, which gradually ate itself because of the acid in its own wood pulp, but rag paper made from cotton scraps, which would last practically forever. It was torn along one edge, where it had been roughly ripped from its host book. A few letters had been left behind in the process, but only a few. The regular, urgent, forward tilt of the black script gave the words a purposeful look, like they were trails of gunpowder leading toward some explosive revelation. Whoever wrote it had had something to say. In places, the text blocks were broken up to make room for charts and diagrams, a table of numbers with a lot of decimal points, a small but precise botanical sketch of a flowerless plant, with neat rows of leaves and a hollow seed pod, an elegant diagram of concentric and overlapping circles and ellipses that could equally easily have been an atom or a solar system. The page began in the middle of one sentence. It ended in the middle of another. When he looked closer, he saw that the leaves of the plant were wavering very slightly in the breeze, and the planets, or electrons, in the diagrams were very slowly progressing in their orbits, which themselves precessed in an orderly dance around one another. The values in the table changed in sync with them. At first, Quentin thought he couldn't read the script at all, and he sighed out loud with relief when he began to recognize a word here and there. It was a late, rather corrupt form of Old High German, written in some eccentric variation of black-letter Gothic. He could hum the tune even if he couldn't quite get every single lyric. That, however, was the last break he caught. The contents were highly theoretical and abstract, seriously high-altitude stuff up there where the conceptual oxygen was dangerously thin. There was a lot of business about magic and matter, and high-level exchanges between the two under extreme conditions at the quantum level. Sometimes it was hard to tell how much of it was literal and how much of it was metaphor. When it talked about a rooster, was that some kind of symbolic alchemical rooster, or was it an actual rooster with feathers, cock-a-doodle-doo? There wasn't much context to go on. And that plant, he was going to have to take this over to Professor Bax in the greenhouse, or as the students referred to it inevitably, Botany Bay. After staring at the page for 3 hours, during which he didn't even make it to the other side, Quentin sat back and pressed the heels of his hands against his aching eyes. He'd missed dinner, but he could still eat with the kitchen staff. One thing was clear. This was a fragment chipped off the great arcane magical database of the adepts of the Netherlands themselves. Penny's gang. It was like an ultra-dense meteorite from some extrasolar intellectual realm, and it had come crashing to Earth, and there was no telling what exotic, unearthly elements it might contain. He'd found a topic for his independent research project, anyway. Dean Fogg could stop nudging him about that. And in a small way he'd found a new adventure. It was a different kind of adventure from what they had in Fillory, a small and kind of nerdy adventure. But there was no question that's what this was. "Thank you," he said to the page. "Thank you for being here. Whatever it is you've got inside you, I'll take good care of it, I promise." Was it his imagination? Did the page unfold itself slightly? Did it preen itself a little, basking in the praise of its reader? He took the heavy candlestick off one corner. then, carefully, the wine glass and the clock. As soon as he moved the ammonite, the page shot sideways, making for the crack under the window. "Not yet." He slapped his hand down on it and replaced the candlestick with a clunk. "I'm sorry, I really am. But not yet." There was one aspect of Quentin's life at Brakebills that was still less than ideal, and that was his social life. He didn't have one. Even though he was almost 30, he was a lot younger than most of the faculty, and he was having a hard time connecting with them. Maybe it was the age thing, or that he hadn't properly paid his dues yet, which was true. Maybe they figured he wouldn't be here that long, so what was the point? The politics of the senior common room were Byzantine and involved a lot of power struggles to which he, as low man on the totem pole, just wasn't very relevant. Also, it was possible that they just didn't like him very much. It had been known to happen. Whatever the reason, he drew a lot of undesirable solo duties, like refereeing cold, wet welters matches and patching the dull but finicky network of spells that was supposed to bust students breaking curfew. Now that he got a close look at it, he couldn't believe how much they used to worry about getting caught. The spells were so rickety and put out so many false alarms that the faculty mostly ignored them. The next day, after PA, Quentin walked over to Botany Bay. His expectations weren't high. He'd never spoken to the department chair, Hamish Bax, and he didn't know what to make of him. On the plus side, he was youngish, at least by Brakebill's standards, mid-30s maybe. On the minus side, he was unbelievably affected. He was black and from Cleveland, but dressed in Scottish tweeds and smoked a fat Turk's head pipe. He was the first person Quentin had ever seen in real life wearing plus fours. The whole business made him hard to read, though maybe that was the point. At least Quentin had an excuse to visit the greenhouse, which was a lovely bit of Victorian iron and glass tracery that looked too delicate to withstand an upstate winter. Inside it was a green bubble of warm, humid air full of tables of potted plants of all imaginable shapes and sizes. The cement floor was wet. Short and solidly built, Professor Bax greeted him with the same lack of interest as the rest of the faculty. He didn't seem particularly pleased to be interrupted doing whatever he was doing with his arms up to the elbows in a giant ceramic pot full of black earth. But he brightened up when Quentin zipped open a velvet-lined portfolio and the page immediately shook itself and wriggled free like a silvery fish escaping a net.
"That's a live one," he said, teeth clenched around his pipe.
He wiped his hands on a rag. Using a quick spell that completely eluded Quentin's comprehension, he trapped the page flat in the air in front of him, as if between two panes of glass. It was the kind of fluent, rather technical magic you didn't expect from a botanist.
"Hmm, you're a long way from home."
Then he addressed Quentin.
"Where'd you get this?"
"I could tell you, but you wouldn't believe me. Do you recognize the plant?"
"I don't. Think it's a real plant, drawn from life?"
"I have no idea," Quentin admitted.
"Do you?"
Professor Bax studied the page for 5 minutes, first from so close his face almost touched the paper, then from a yard away, then he had to shift a table crammed with seedlings in egg cartons, from across the room. He took his pipe out of his mouth.
"I'm going to say a word you don't know."
"Okay," Quentin said.
"Phyllotaxis."
"Don't know it."
"It's the way leaves are arranged around a central stalk," Professor Bax said. "It looks chaotic, but it's not. It follows a mathematical sequence. Usually Fibonacci, sometimes Lucas. But the leaves on this plant don't follow either of those, which suggests that its origin is exceptionally exotic."
"Or that it's just a made-up drawing."
"Right. And Occam's razor says it probably is. And yet," Hamish frowned, "it's got something. Plants have a certain integrity to them, you know. Hard to fake that. You're sure you can't tell me where it's from?
I shouldn't.
Don't then, he gestured at the text. Can you read that shit?
I'm working on it. Professor Bax released the page from its trap. He plucked it out of the air before it could fall. It was limp and pliant in his hands. It seemed more submissive to his authority than to Quentin's.
Grand, he said. Drink?
Yes, was the only possible answer. Bax retrieved a fifth of rye from in among the flower pots, where he'd apparently hastily concealed it right before Quentin came in. Just like that, Quentin had shattered whatever invisible barrier stood between him and the rest of the faculty, or at least one member of the faculty. It emerged over the course of the afternoon that Hamish wasn't much more popular with the other professors than Quentin was. Whatever nameless sin Quentin had committed, Hamish had committed it too. They were the same kind of radioactive. Quentin started coming by the greenhouse regularly after practical applications, and he and Hamish would have a couple of whiskies before dinner. Hamish initiated him into some of the deeper mysteries of the Brakebills campus. What was really surprising was how much of the stuff that the undergraduates whispered about after hours was actually true. That blank stretch of wall, for example, where there ought to have been a room and the plaster was a shade lighter, that really wasn't an air shaft. Back in the 1950s, some students had set up a cubic thermal field in their room, possibly to keep beer cold. But having already consumed some of the beer, they inverted a couple of glyphs, which had the unexpected effect of driving the temperature inside down very close to absolute zero. The resulting field was so stable that nobody could figure out a way to dispel it. It was perfectly harmless unless you walked into it, in which case you'd be dead before you knew it. One of the kids who cast it lost a hand that way, or so it was said. Eventually, the faculty just shrugged their shoulders and walled it off. Supposedly, the lost, frozen hand was still in there. Likewise, it was true, the clock was powered by a gear made of metal reclaimed from the body of the silver golem of Bialystok. It was also true that there was a childishly humorous anagram for Brakebills, that it was biker balls, and that the chalkboards would squeak painfully if you tried to write it on them. It was true that ivy wouldn't grow on that one bare patch of wall behind the kitchens because one of the stones had been violently cursed in a really ugly incident involving a student who'd slipped through the admissions protocols meant to screen out sociopaths and other people mentally unfit to handle magic. On humid days, it sweated acid. There was also a secret seventh fountain, underground, accessible through a door set in the dusty plank floor of a gardening shed. It was kept cordoned off because the water teemed with hungry, sharp-toothed fish. And Quentin had never known how the maze was redrawn over the summer, but apparently every year in June the groundskeeper goaded the topiary animals into such a feeding frenzy that they fell upon and devoured each other in a kind of ghastly, slow-motion, vegetarian holocaust. The maze was built up again out of cuttings from the survivors. Only the strongest made it through. They must have been some of the most highly evolved topiary animals on Earth. This was Quentin's world now, and it was amazing to him how quickly he came to accept it, even embrace it. He'd gone from king to schoolteacher, been forcibly transplanted from the grand magical cosmos of Fillory to this hole in the wall that he thought he'd escaped forever, and lo and behold, he was adjusting. It turns out you can go home again if you have to. His future was here. The years he'd spent in Fillory were gone now, as if they'd never happened. He mourned them alone. The only person on Earth who knew that once upon a time he used to wear a crown and sit on a throne. But you couldn't mourn forever. Or you could, but as it turned out, there were better things to do. Pacing the aisles of a silent classroom, surveying the exposed napes of rows and rows of students bent over their fall exams, he realized he'd lost his old double vision,
the one that was always looking for something more, somewhere else, the world behind the world. It was his oldest possession, and he'd let it slip away without even noticing it was gone. He was becoming someone else, someone new. It was crazy to think that the others were still over there, riding out on hunts, receiving people in their receiving rooms, meeting every afternoon in the tallest tower of Castle Whitespire. And Julia was on the far side of the world doing God knew what. But that had nothing to do with him now. After all that, it turned out, that wasn't his story. It had all been a temporary aberration, and in due time it had corrected itself. Though he did still look up at the moon once in a while, expecting to find the clean, crisp crescent of Fillory. By comparison, Earth's moon looked as pale and shabby and worn as an old dime. They were only 100 miles north of Manhattan, but the winters at Brakebills had a different quality from winter in the city, deeper, heavier, firmer, more decisive. It was as if, because it came 3 months late, Brakebills winter was determined to suck you in for good and all. It was February on the outside, and the birds and plants were beginning to show glimmers of cautious optimism, but Brakebills was still wallowing in a foot and a half of deep, silent November snow. Now that he was teaching, Quentin could see why the faculty didn't bother trying to improve the climate. It kept people amazingly focused. You saw the undergrads try to jog their way through the snow, kicking up puffs of powder, then give up and just slog. You could actually watch as the determination to seize the moment and live life to the fullest ebbed right out of them, and they resigned themselves to lonely, silent, indoor study instead. There was a perennial proposal on the table, never quite adopted, to keep it winter at Brakebills all year round. Quentin was doing quite a bit of studying himself. He'd transcribed the whole page, 402 words arranged in 20 sentences, plus an incomplete one at the beginning and another at the end, and papered his walls with it. Each word got its own separate sheet, which he filled up with annotations and connected to other words with long, curvy chalk lines to indicate related concepts. He was literally living inside the page. He kept up with his teaching, but other than that, decrypting the page was his full-time occupation. As he got deeper into it, he began to run into a lot of mathematics, which he had to work out with a pencil and paper. You couldn't do magical equations with computers. They just spat out inconsistent answers before hanging completely. Magical math had to be thought through with a brain. But the page was beginning to open up. Like tightly furled buds, the words began to bloom and reveal the ideas locked inside them. The concepts unfolded for him, displaying hidden dimensions and interacting with one another in unexpected ways. As they took shape, they also gave up clues as to the much larger, more shadowy whole of which they were just a tiny fragment, the book that the page came from. It appeared to be a treatise on the interactions between magic and matter. On Earth, magic and matter were distinct things. You could cast a spell on an object, and it became enchanted, but the object and the spell remained separate entities. The object was like a piece of metal on which you'd put a magnetic charge. But in Fillory, Quentin knew, or at least strongly suspected, magic and thing were somehow one and the same. Magic existed on Earth, sure, but Fillory was magic. It was a fundamental difference. This was all very theoretical, and Quentin wasn't that into theory. He was still a physical kid at heart, and he was more into practice. Under the right conditions, with enough energy, could you make something on Earth magic? Infuse it with magic? Melt them together till the seams were gone like they were in Fillory? It felt like a forbidden idea, a boundary you weren't supposed to cross, but it was too delicious not to at least try. He requisitioned an empty basement lab, but even with his newly enhanced magical abilities, it was difficult to force the delicate abstractions of the page into the crude actual world. Either he came up with nothing, or one of the spells would release a huge wad of energy that lit up the room with icy blue light and practically blew out the wards he'd set up to keep himself from being vaporized. As a precaution, he worked the enchantments inside increasingly large, heavy, gluey globes of force, like bubbles blown from a thick, viscous, translucent liquid, which made it hard to tell what exactly was going on. And what would he do with it anyway, even if it did work? What good was something magic? This was a powerful enchantment, but it needed a purpose. It was an answer in search of a question. He was getting older, and it was time he thought about making something, building something that would last. But what? He couldn't see how this was getting him any closer. One evening, standing alone in the senior common room, drinking his first glass of wine for the night and sketching diagrams in his head, he reached into his jacket pocket for his Philorian watch, which still didn't work, but he liked having it with him anyway, and found an envelope there along with it. Inside was a letter typed on a manual typewriter, inviting him politely, even decorously, to show up at such-and-such a bookstore on such-and-such a night in March if he was interested in a job. The signature was illegible. Bird scratchings. Huh. It was intriguing, and Quentin felt a little of the old restlessness. Here it was, another mystery to be solved. Your classic passport to adventure, just like back in the old days. But that was the thing about the old days. They were old. This was his life now. He was content, if not happy, then happier than he ever thought he'd be again. He had work to do. He crumpled up the letter and winged it into the fire. It caught, and a heavy log shifted, sending up sparks. The past was what it was. His home was here, and anything else was a fantasy. Chapter 5. Elliot frowned. The Lorian champion was a squat fellow, practically as wide as he was tall, and of some slightly different ethnic background from most of his compatriots. The Lorians were Vikings, basically, Thor types. Tall, long blonde hair, big chins, big chests, big beards. But this character came in at about 5'6", with a shaved head and a fat, round Buddha face like a soup dumpling and a significant admixture of some Asiatic DNA. He was stripped to the waist, even though it was about 40 degrees out, and his latte-colored skin was oiled all over. Or maybe he was just really sweaty. The champion's heavy, round gut hung down over his waistband, but he was still a pretty scary-looking bastard. He had a huge saddle of muscle across his upper back, and his biceps were like thighs. And there must have been some muscle in there, just by volume, even if they did look kind of chubby. His weapon was weird-looking enough, a pole arm with a big curvy cross of sharp metal on the end, that you just knew he could do something really outstandingly dangerous with it. When he stepped forward, the Lorian army went nuts for him. They bashed their swords and shields together and looked at each other as if to say, "Yes, he may look a little funny, but our fellow is definitely going to kill the other fellow's fellow. So three cheers for him, by Crom, or whoever it is we worship." It almost made you like them, the Lorians. They were more multicultural than you would have thought. Though there was no chance that their champion was actually going to kill the Philorian champion, Elliot's champion. Because Elliot's champion was Elliot. There had been some debate when the idea was first mooted about whether it made sense to send the High King of Fillory into single combat with the hand-picked designated hitter of the invading Lorian army, but it rapidly became clear that Elliot was set on it, though his reasons were as much personal as they were tactical. He had begun his stint as High King in a rather decadent vein. Louche, you might even say. but as his reign lengthened, he had grown into the role and become more serious about it, and it was time he showed everybody, himself included, how serious he was. Kingship was not an affectation, it was who he was. Very publicly, very literally, he was going to put some skin in the game. He stepped forward from the front rank of his army, who, predictably but gratifyingly, also went nuts. Elliot smiled. His smile was twisted by his uneven jaw, but his happiness was the real stuff. His heart was in it. The sound of the king's regiment of the Felorian army cheering was unlike anything else in the known universe. You had men and women shouting and banging their weapons together good enough, but then you had a whole orchestra of non-human sounds going on around it. At the top end, you had some fairies squeeing at supersonic pitches. Fairies thought all this military stuff was pretty silly, but they went along with it for the same reason that fairies ever did anything, namely for the lulls. Then you had bats squeaking, birds squawking, bears roaring, wolves howling, and anything with a horse head whinnying. Pegasi, unicorns, regular talking horses. Griffins and hippogriffs squawked too, but lower, baritone squawking, a horrible noise. Minotaurs bellowed. Stuff with humans' heads yelled. Of all the mythical creatures of Fillory, they were the only ones who still creeped Elliot out. The satyrs and dryads and such were cool, but there were a couple of manticores and sphinxes who were just uncanny as hell. And so on down the line till you got to the bass notes, which were provided by the giants, grunting and stomping their feet. It was silly, really. He could have picked a giant as his champion, and then this thing would have been over in about 10 seconds flat. Pun intended. But that wouldn't have sent the same message. When Elliot first got the news that the Lorians were invading, it had been grimly exciting. Rally the banners, Fillory's at war, antique formulas and protocols were invoked, a lot of serious-looking non-ceremonial armor and weapons and flags and tack had come up out of storage and been polished and sharpened and oiled. They brought up with them a lot of dust, too, and a thrilling smell of great deeds and legendary times, an epic smell. Elliot breathed it in deep. The invasion wasn't a complete surprise. The Lorians were always up to some kind of bad behavior in the books, kidnapping princes, forcing talking horses to plow fields, trying to get everybody to believe in their slate of quasi-Norse gods. But it had been centuries since they actually crossed the border in force. They were usually too busy fighting among themselves to get that organized. More to the point, the peaks of the northern barrier range were supposed to be enchanted to keep the Lorians out. That was the barrier part. Elliot wasn't sure what had happened there. When this was all over, he'd have to remember to figure out exactly why those spells had crapped out. Elliot moved rapidly to expel the Lorians, though he found himself reluctant to be the direct cause of any actual killing. This wasn't Tolkien. These weren't orcs and trolls and giant spiders and whatever else, evil creatures that you were free to commit genocide on without any complicated moral ramifications. Orcs didn't have wives and kids and backstories. But he was pretty sure the Lorians were human, and killing them would be basically murder, and that wasn't going to happen. Some of them were even kind of hot. And anyway, those Tolkien books were fiction. And Elliot, as High King of Fillory, didn't deal in fiction. He was in the messy business of writing facts. It was a tricky, ticklish business. There was nothing, in Elliot's admittedly limited experience, more tedious than virtue. Fortunately, the Felorians had an advantage, which was that they had every possible advantage. They outmatched the Lorians in every stat you could name. The Lorians were a bunch of guys with swords. The Felorians were every beast in the monster manual, led by a clique of wizard kings and queens, and Elliot was very sorry, but you knew that when you invaded us. Still, there were a lot of them, and they knew how to do damage. Doing damage was pretty much these guys' skill set. It was late spring when the Lorians came pouring through Grudge Gap and onto Fillorian soil. They wore steel caps and mail shirts and carried notched old swords and war axes. Some rode big, shaggy horses,